I'm another one in a long line of the old timers who will be speaking to you today about the early days. It was really fun to hear Steve and Mike talk about events and people who I had long forgotten, or at least perhaps intentionally forgotten. It really is hard to believe that it's been more than 30 years since Merlo and Circlo were passed. I was involved in the passage of Merlo and also in some of the early amendments. What Mike didn't say was that Merlo actually passed twice. In the first year, after it got through 10 committees and through two houses of the legislature, the governor vetoed it, and it had to be passed a second time. So 1983 was when it actually passed. One caveat, I like others here, a lot of my reflections on Superfund will be based on past experiences. I now have a few ongoing Superfund cases, but in the last 8 years or so, I've mostly worked on water quality issues or on mining issues. Many of you are probably young enough that you've probably spent your whole professional careers under the Superfund regime. But to understand why CERCLA and Merlo were really novel and radical when they were enacted in the early 1980s, you really need to understand how the law worked before they were passed. Let's see if I can make this work. Yeah. In private transactions, common law applied. If you live next door to a waste dump and you thought it was a nuisance and you wanted it cleaned up, or you thought it was polluting your well, you had to bring a common law tort suit. And in order to prevail, in order to make the defendant do something, you had to show that he had engaged in some action that exhibited fault. He was negligent, or he had violated some law or some standard. Then you had to prove that that action was the actual cause of some specific damage. If a matter involved a governmental enforcement action, the government also had to bring a lawsuit. It had to show that the defendant had violated a law, and this lawsuit resulted in a court hearing in which the court, not the government, decided who was right. Superfund changed all that. It changed the common law tort approach by providing a remediation regime based on strict liability, meaning no need to show fault, no need to show a violation of law. As Al pointed out, many of the disposal practices that gave rise to Superfund liability were entirely legal. It covered past actions. In fact, in order to be liable under Superfund, you only had to fall within a category. You had to be a generator or a transporter or an owner-operator of a site. It was retroactive. It covered past actions and past disposals. The rationale for this was that as between the taxpayer and the person who perhaps achieved some economic benefit from the activity, who should pay? As Mike pointed out, it also provided for joint and several liability and for sort of lower standards of causation. Even if there were multiple parties responsible for a contamination problem, the government could choose to focus on only one of them and place the entire burden of the remediation on him. It would then be up to him to sue the others to try to recover from them their share of the costs. Also, it really wasn't necessary any longer to establish any kind of specific causation link between the specific substances that that responsible party had deposited and the damage that was suffered. Superfund also changed actions by the government. The government now could simply issue a unilateral order telling a responsible party to clean up, and that order could not be challenged in court until after the cleanup was completed. Thus, if a responsible party refused to comply with that order, if he thought he was not really responsible, or if he thought the remediation plan was too much or too costly, he risked severe penalties, and he risked having to reimburse the government for its cleanup costs, and perhaps a multiple of those costs, or both. The rationale for that was that, as you have heard, is that these abandoned hazardous waste sites were so important, I mean, so dangerous, and it was such an emergency that we needed to clean them up right now and litigate later. Litigation would postpone that cleanup. Now, none of these legal doctrines was new. For example, the common law strict liability was a well-known doctrine applied to dangerous kinds of activities. If you, for example, kept your pet tiger in Minneapolis, the common law would hold you strictly liable for any damage it caused, no matter how careful you were, saying, you know, even if Minneapolis lets you keep tigers, it's a really dangerous practice, and we don't care how careful you are, if that tiger eats someone and you get sued, you're paying the costs. Similarly, retroactive liability and joint and several liability were recognized doctrines in certain defined circumstances, and even the governmental enforcement actions recognized in some, there was some administrative law which indicated you couldn't challenge the government until there was final agency action. What was new was that Superfund took all of these doctrines and applied all of them together to the disposal of hazardous substances, and it provided for only a very few limited defenses, like an act of God or an act of war. The result was that a person who had lawfully disposed of hazardous substances at a site many years ago, or who was the successor in interest to the person who did it, could be ordered to remediate all the contamination at that site, even if others had contributed to the contamination problem, and even if most of the damage caused by the substances that, or was caused by the substances that those others had contributed, and he could not challenge that cleanup order without risking severe penalties and potentially higher remediation costs. MRLA, the state superfund, went even further and provided for the right of people to bring lawsuits for personal injury and property damage caused by past disposal of hazardous substances, and also radically lowered the standard of causation people would have to prove to show that hazardous substances had actually caused injury. Not surprisingly, the reaction of most companies subject to Superfund for the first time was, can they do that? This is un-American. And as a lawyer, it was often often the subject of my first meeting with a Superfund client to explain, yes, they can do that, and the courts have generally upheld all of these controversial provisions. Many of these companies, as Al pointed out, were engaged in what they thought were responsible practices. They were consolidating their toxic hazardous substances in an area of the ground rather than dumping them in the river. And those were the people that got caught up. One of the major effects that Superfund has had from the lawyer's point of view, certainly it's had an effect on the cleanup of hazardous waste sites, which was, of course, its purpose. It's also had a major effect on the future management of hazardous waste and on the way certain private party transactions are conducted, and it's had an effect on some institutional arrangements. All of these effects have evolved and changed over the course of the last 30-some years. Let's talk about the institutional arrangements first. First of all, it created large cleanup bureaucracies at the EPA and at the PCA, which promulgated a host of associated new rules, policies, and procedures. Superfund was a massive program, and it needed a lot of people to implement it. Like all bureaucracies, governmental or corporate or academic, as you go up the ladder, up through supervisors to the top folks, you tend to find people who are generally see the big picture, who are flexible, see nuance, see gray. But the people who generally did the actual implementing of Superfund, the people you had to work with on a day-to-day basis, were often, not always, often there were some fine, excellent people, but there were often younger, some inexperienced people bound by a more narrow vision because it was above their pay grade to see the different alternatives. These were the folks that were often making cleanup decisions. Also, because thousands of companies were caught up in the Superfund liability net, the law created a huge demand for lawyers and for consultants, folks like Al and me. Al and the others are the expert on Superfund consulting firms, and I think there's going to be a talk on that later this afternoon. But I can talk about lawyers. From the 1980s through the mid-90s, every major law firm had an environmental law department. Now, mostly these were not lawyers who knew NEPA or the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air Act or even RCRA, but they were litigators working on Superfund cases. And because Superfund and its provisions were new, there were a host of new legal issues that needed to be addressed and resolved. There are really three main issues in a Superfund case. Who's liable? What's the remedy, or how clean is clean? And how do you allocate the cleanup costs? Lawyers weighed in on all of these issues, though most of the legal challenges, the early legal challenges to Superfund's liability provisions were pretty soon decided against the responsible parties, creating a new rule of law, which is in Superfund, the government wins. But a major complaint about Superfund in its early days was that that transaction costs, and often lawyer-related transaction costs, really outweighed cleanup costs. Lawyers were there trying to help their clients to escape liability, to negotiate a reasonably priced cleanup in a new area, and to transfer most of the cost burden to other people. And as Mike and others have alluded to, there were some cowboys in that bar. I can remember one guy who wanted to drink trichloroethylene in front of the PCA board to show it wasn't dangerous. You know, he's no longer with us, of course. But an example would be the Isanti Sites case, which I think Steve mentioned. It's a case that I worked on with Al's firm. This was the first major Superfund case in Minnesota, brought in the mid-'80s, and it involved spent solvents. Both EPA and the PCA were involved, and many major Minnesota corporations were among the responsible parties sued. 3M, Honeywell, Control Data, Valspar, others. All of these companies had tried to act responsibly by not disposing of their spent solvents in, say, some river, but by sending them to a recycler. A recycler named Neil Armstrong, like the astronaut, who called his company cleverly Rocket Products. There wasn't any rocket science involved in his recycling operation, I can tell you that. When he couldn't handle all the solvents that were being sent to him, he simply sent the drums home with his employees, who buried them or left them lying about their farms. Needless to say, when the time came for cleanup, Neil and his folks really didn't have the money to pay for that, so EPA and MPCA looked to the companies. I mention this case because every major Twin Cities law firm was involved in it. There were many, many meetings of lawyers. There were meetings of lawyers in front of the federal magistrate in which the lawyers were ordered to come only with high-level people from their corporations who had absolute settlement authority. So I was there with the vice president of 3M. Others were there with the president of Honeywell. The case went on for years. Complicated settlement documents and future funding arrangements were negotiated. And yet the final amount that was spent on cleanup, as I look back on it, was incredibly small by today's standards. I think EPA's past costs were $1 million, maybe less, not much more if they were more. And I think the final remedy approved by the MPCA was in the hundreds of thousands. Now, I suspect that the total legal fees and transaction costs far exceeded those amounts. This problem of lawyer-related transaction costs reached its zenith with respect to the many closed landfills in the state, as there were more than 100 of them, as you have heard. And these dumps had been used by hundreds of organizations to dispose of materials containing hazardous substances for years. And the parties who were named by the MPCA as responsible generally turned around and sued others so that they would share the cost, to the point where, at one point, even Boy Scout troops were being brought into these negotiations. And everybody had a lawyer. I remember a cartoon from The New Yorker where there's a bunch of people sitting around a conference table, and everyone is accompanied by a lawyer who looks exactly like every other lawyer. And at the door, there's a person standing with two lawyers, and he's saying, "Did anyone lose a lawyer? I seem to have two." This was finally resolved by the Landfill Cleanup Act that was discussed earlier, which essentially allowed responsible parties to assign their insurance policies to the PCA and to get a release in return, thus wiping out in one fell swoop most of the Superfund bar. And other changes also occurred over the years to relieve the rough edges of Superfund liability scheme and to reduce the need for lawyer. The personal injury property damage provision of MRLA was repealed and replaced by a new administrative system for compensating victims of hazardous substances. CERCLA and MRLA were both amended, or they were interpreted by the courts over the years to provide or to clarify protections for innocent landowners, neighboring property owners, lenders, governments with tax-forfeited land, parent corporations, et cetera. The result is, while there are still lawyers working on Superfund cleanup cases, Superfund litigation has diminished, and many, if not most, law firms no longer really have an environmental law department. The Superfund also, in addition to having an effect on institutions like lawyers and consulting firms, had an effect on site cleanup, obviously. That was its purpose. And it did result in site cleanups, as you have heard, or at least in ongoing cleanups, whether they are completed or not. As I read some recently that as of 2009, at least, responsible parties had contributed something like $30 billion to cleaning up sites. From the lawyer's perspective, the details of remediation that Al was talking about, how clean is clean, fall far more within the province of the engineering consultants like Al, and they raise fewer legal questions for us. But as a lawyer, my observations were, one, that the remedy process seems long and time-consuming, that it involved many complex studies, in fact, far more studies than cleanups, that the cleanup standards and remedies also seemed way out of proportion to the risk, that often resulted in far more money being spent to control minimal risks from abandoned hazardous waste sites, when far less money was being spent to control far greater environmental risks from other activities. It was not hard to notice that the governments tended to impose more expensive and complicated remedies on private party cleanups than they did on themselves, on fund cleanups. Again, all of this got better over time with various amendments to the laws or new policies like shaping cleanup standards to prospective land use, creating more of a risk-based hierarchy of remedies, focusing on chief contaminants rather than all of them, and a willingness to consider things like natural attenuation and monitored attenuation rather than pump and treat. But from a lawyer's perspective, two matters about remedy selection stand out to me. First, the concept of ARARs. These include standards that are not the law, that are not applicable, but are merely relevant and appropriate. But they somehow get transformed in Superfund into legal requirements. This may be justifiable in some instances, but to a lawyer's mind, it exhibits a certain procedural sloppiness that doesn't really comport with the rule of law. At least CERCLA provides for ARARs. It's mentioned in the text of the statute. Minnesota, the PCA, also uses the ARAR concept, although you can read MRLA through again and again and not find any authority for that use in the statute. Second, CERCLA and MRLA basically made it either impossible or pretty dangerous for a responsible party to say no to a cleanup, and made it impossible for them to challenge it in court because the cleanup wasn't complete. A responsible party risked penalties by saying to the EPA or MPCA, "No, we're not going to comply with your cleanup order because we don't think we're responsible, or we don't think this remediation plan which you have selected is justifiable." Again, the reasons for this procedural arrangement were that the cleanups of hazardous waste sites were so important that they were emergencies and they have to be done now. Litigation will merely delay those remedies, and so litigation will just have to be postponed until after we have the quick and efficient cleanup of all these sites. Well, really, as you've heard, a lot of those cleanups are still going on for 20 years or more. I mean, could it really have been that impossible to engage in legitimate disputes about those sites? And was it really fair? Is it really fair not to provide for that kind of a chance? There was one time when I did represent a client that pretty much was prepared to say no. This was we would not comply with the with the remediation plan. This had to do with the complex contaminated sediment site up near Duluth Harbor, the St. Louis River site, which is more and more, I think, the kind of complex site that will be the subject of future Superfund questions. And I raise this issue because it led to a model for remediation selection that is worth looking at, especially when you're dealing with complicated, complex sites. The issue there was over how to remedy contaminated sediments. The MPCA wanted us to dredge them all up. Our clients came in and said, we want to cap the sediments. There were real technical disputes. We had a lot of engineering expertise, hundreds of years of engineering expertise on our team. My recollection is the MPCA had no engineers on their team and disapproved it on engineering grounds that I was checking. Well, we basically let the staff know and the board, the MPCA board, know that we did not agree with this. The PCA, in fairness, there were a lot of unresolved technical questions about dredging and capping. They were both relatively new technologies in the context of Superfund. So the board stepped in, really, and took the matter out of the hands of the normal process and said, we want a peer review team, not from Minnesota, to look at these issues. And that's what they created. We negotiated a peer review agreement. We established a peer review team of 8 outside peer reviewers, none of them from Minnesota, with expertise in the areas which were the subject of dispute. They identified data gaps. Both the PCA staff and the RPs provided the responses to those data gaps, and then there were constant meetings between the PCA staff and the RPs with this peer review team, which became a really collaborative decision-making process towards the end. That resulted in meetings of all the stakeholders that were involved, which were many here, not merely the RPs and the PCA, but wildlife agencies, the EPA, the state of Wisconsin, harbor interest, landowner interests, who had differing views on the kind of cleanup that they wanted. There were meetings of stakeholders. The peer review team reported back to this big meeting of stakeholders. Here are the results of the findings we have found on these disputed technical issues. And then they broke up the meeting into small groups. Each small group had a member of the peer review team, an RP and others, and they were assigned to come out and they were assigned to take the next 2 or 3 hours and design an alternative remedy. They came back with ideas, some of them remarkable ideas, and those ideas formed the basis of a new remediation plan, a hybrid dredge cap remediation plan, which we negotiated and fine-tuned over the course of several months. And it finally resulted in a remediation plan that all the parties could live with. Nobody was entirely happy with it, but everyone could live with it, and all the stakeholders were also able to live with it. So when that was, I think, a good model for a non-adversarial kind of approach. Did I lose my slide here? Yeah, there it is. Finally, let me talk for a minute about the effect of Superfund on the management of waste and private transactions. In my opinion, whether it was intended or not, this is what Superfund has had the greatest impact on, how companies manage their waste and on how private parties, even without a Superfund claim against them, now approach certain business transactions. These changes are not measurable very easily, like counting the number of NPL sites that have been delisted. But my sense as a lawyer is that the changes in these areas have been profound. There are several reasons for this. One, first, because of the new potential liabilities and stringent liabilities under Superfund, associated with hazardous waste disposal, both under Superfund and under RCRA, many companies simply change their processes to eliminate the generation of hazardous waste or to substantially reduce them. Second, they certainly stopped sending them home with their employees to dump in the back 40, which was common, not more common than you might think, actually. I once had a client who, a consultant told me, you should go, this client needs some legal advice, and this was in a different state, but I arrived to find myself having arrived a half hour after the state had arrived and read him his rights. So he said, well, we're not going to say anything today, until I know what's going on. But Superfund created a whole new practice and profession of due diligence with respect to waste disposal and management. For example, companies would no longer send their wastes off to a disposal site or to a recycler without a lot of vetting of those places, because any contamination problems arising there later would be their responsibility. Equally important, Superfund created a new practice and profession of environmental due diligence with respect to property transfers and mergers and acquisitions. I think for several years after Superfund's passage, the transfer of contaminated land essentially stopped. And because companies were no longer purchasing contaminated land, that resulted in some private cleanups by buyers who couldn't sell their land otherwise, or by sellers who exacted a cleanup cost as part of their purchase price. As with everything with regard to Superfund, these changes occurred over many years. I can remember the first time I represented a company that bought another company that was responsible for a major Superfund site, not only a Superfund site, but a site on the NPL. I was a much younger lawyer then, and I remember being incredibly nervous about this and going out of my way to advise them about all the risks that they were taking on. And we were in a situation where the seller said, we're going to give you all the documents we have. We're not hiding anything from you. Here are all the documents, but you cannot go on our site. We do not want you to inspect our site. We do not want you finding things that we don't know about and then walking away and leaving us. So I was locked in a law firm in Houston in the middle of a hurricane, as I recall, with our company's in-house technical staff and with an outside consultant, and we went through these documents, and we evaluated the environmental risk, and we costed it out, and the company negotiated a reduction in purchase price, and they bought the company, and so far as I know, everything worked out. And as you have heard, there have been changes in the law, too. We in Minnesota, the VIC program, federal programs and concepts like bona fide prospective purchasers and the brownfield programs that Paul's going to talk about. And basically, over time, companies got more comfortable at how to assess these risks, how to cost them out, and how to manage them. And the laws got amended slowly to encourage that. So, finally, has Superfund worked from a lawyer's perspective? Yes. Has it worked really well? Mixed reviews there. As I said, I think probably its greatest success was changing current and future waste management practices. Has it worked at cleaning up sites? It's clearly done that to some degree. Has it been efficient and cost-effective? I don't think so. On the other hand, what alternative programs have worked, like a massive brownfields program, it's hard to say. Studies were undertaken in, say, the early to mid-90s by respectable institutions like the Keystone Institute, and they never were able to come up with a real alternative to the Superfund liability scheme. Would a massive public works program have worked? RPs here have contributed $30 billion. I would guess controversies over that kind of a public works program might dwarf the disputes you're seeing over light rail, for example. But from a lawyer's perspective, Superfund created other problems too. I think it created a subtle but real change in how governmental agencies approach regulated parties. There is now, I think, more of a looseness about due process, a presumption that the government sometimes doesn't need to prove its case, that legal requirements ought to be precise, and that agencies ought to be held accountable in court. And there is some in the government who still take the Superfund attitude over to other areas, not unpredictably, that the government should win in any kind of environmental area. Is this surprising to me? No, not really. The law, especially statutes like Superfund, which are intended to be remedial for a broad societal problem, are always blunt instruments. They're never surgical scalpels. I've learned over many years as a lawyer now that justice is only rough. It's never precise. It's the job of lawyers in individual cases to hone that blunt instrument into as much of a scalpel as it can be. Hopefully, we lawyers and the Superfund Bar have managed to do that over the years with respect to the original laws in a way that has reasonably kept pace with the new developments in understanding environmental problems arising from hazardous waste sites, to keep a pace with new technologies and to keep a pace with the needs of business and the rest of society. Let me close with a quote from the greatest political novel in American literature, All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren, where Willie Stark, the Huey Long figure, who was a lawyer, is describing the law to one of his friends and says, "The law is like the pants you bought last year for a growing boy, but it is always this year. And the seams were popped and the shank bones to the breeze. The law is too short and too tight for growing humankind. The best you can do is do something and then make up some law to fit. And by the time that law gets onto the books, you would have done something else." So.